accession number 9423, reel 7.
Mr. Plimmer, reel 7. You were describing preparations for going into battle, and you mentioned people making their will, and you said you didn't. Can you think of any other things that people did before they actually went into fight?
Not particularly. They might have spent some time thinking about the situation. I should imagine that when people went over the top, say on the 1st of July 1916, when they were going into a real bloody mess, they might have had their own peculiar thought. It would be individual. People probably would think of home. Anyhow, there's a song about that, isn't there? That song that was born of the American Civil War. I don't know the name of the song, but I know the first two or three lines go, "Just before the battle, mother, I am thinking most of you." I don't know if you've ever heard it or not, have you? Well, I mean, they might have been thinking of home. Some people might be incapable of thinking. They might have regarded the situation as being such that they were incapable of thought.
Can you remember what you felt at the time?
I never felt anything at all. Well, I never went into this attack from the trenches. The attack that I was in was all in the open ground.
Yes, I'm referring to that.
Over that. No, I never thought about anything. It was just a day's work. I never thought it was anything, you know, than I was just going forward with the rest of the people. I knew that I was not alone. I knew that I wasn't fighting the war myself. And what happened to other people might happen to me, and what happened to me could happen to other people. It was just a case of taking it as it was. You hadn't got time to deliberate on things. I got no time to form an opinion on whether I should do this or I should do that, or whether I thought the officer was doing right or wrong. I had to do what he was told. You weren't bullied into that sort of thing. You'd know you'd got to go forward to do this particular point. You might have to creep along a hedge for a quarter of a mile, but you didn't take any notice of it. Machine gun bullets might be coming over, but they weren't hitting you, and you'd just go on and on and on.
Can you remember if you wrote any letters home before the battle started, or to see other people?
I might have sent off one of these cards. I never was much of a letter writer. The only person I ever wrote to was my mother, that's all.
Before we actually go on to describe the operation, there's one thing that I failed to mention. Could you describe the mental condition of your own unit that you were in? Would you say that they were as calm as you seem to have been before the battle?
Well, we used to get mail from home. We used to get newspapers. We knew quite well what was going on. We were advancing day by day. We weren't retiring. We weren't stopping still. The Germans were going back faster than we could catch them, and we knew quite well that the time would come when we would win the war. We was aware that the Turks and the Bulgarians and the Romanians had sued for peace and had gotten an armistice, and we knew before the armistice came along that it was in the offing. We didn't know for certain, but there's a fella in the war called Rumour. He knows everything, you see. And we, you know, that generally speaking, that the war was going to end shortly. And it wasn't until, well, we were well past Cambrai, we were almost into Belgium before we knew that actually it was going to, you know, we were told it would end on the 11th. Although it wasn't until the 11th that we were officially told by then.
Right, thank you. Could you tell me now where you first went into action?
Yes, that would be on approach to Cambrai, the town of Cambrai. It was on fire. Cambrai was burning. I remember we went forward at night time. You know, sky was illuminated by Cambrai. And we went into Cambrai in the morning. Then after Cambrai, it was some time before we got into action again. One town I remember went to was a town called Avesnes. E-V-E-S-N-E-S. I remember a battle there.
Perhaps could you tell me what you did at Cambrai before you described
it? Well, we just walked into Cambrai, took off our equipment, went into empty houses and stopped there. Somebody else went through. We stayed in Cambrai for probably 2 or 3 days.
Were you shelled at all at that time?
Not a particularly, not in my area. But I don't think, well, I'm sure we never had any casualties at all when it was in Cumbria. It was being shelled, but the place was burning, on fire in some parts. But we just went into the town of Cumbria, which was in a shambles, and got to a place where we went into some houses and stayed there until we moved on again, perhaps 2 or 3 days.
Did you do anything whilst you were there?
Nothing at all, only kept our guns clean and that sort of thing. No more. Nothing else. Mm-hmm. No training or anything.
And from Canberra, you moved up to Avesnes. Could you describe
what
you
did? Well, we moved off there. We went through, and this place, Avesnes, I think it was at Avesnes where we buried these boys. Then on another occasion, between Avesnes and Salomis, we went forward one night time, and we had to occupy a ridge. And we occupied this ridge without any opposition whatsoever. We dug ourselves in, made ourselves comfortable for the night, and in the morning we got shelled by our own artillery very, very heavily. We lost a lot of people. They shelled us. They thought we were Germans. And they killed a lot of our people, did a lot of damage before we could stop them.
Did you realise straight away that it was
Our own people. I can remember when the war was over, people who had lost relatives in the war, they used to write to the machine gun corps records asking if they could find anybody who could tell them anything about their relative. I got a letter from a woman in Manchester. I won't mention her name, just in case she hears this recording. And she wanted to know, she'd asked if I could tell her about her son. Her son was killed about 3 or 4 yards from me by one of our own shells. I wrote back and told her that I'd seen him killed, but I didn't tell her she was killed by one of our own shells. Yeah, I remember that very well.
Can you tell me how you reacted to this particular incident?
Well, we were very annoyed to start off with. We got down into our holes as well as we were walking about on the top at the time when it happened. You know, just waiting for something to happen. This did happen. They shelled us. Well, as soon as the shell, I dived down into my ditch and I just happened to look, and there was this bloke, well, in his name, he just went flat on his back, and I looked up and I saw him breathing his last. He was several of our blokes got caught on the top there with his artillery.
How did the artillery come to stop? How was the news
got to
them?
I suppose that somebody would signal them to stop. They got signals, you know.
How long did the shelling last for?
Oh, if you think about 3 or 4 minutes. Just long enough to do a lot of damage.
What happened to the machine gun corps after that? Was it very badly damaged in terms of casualties?
We got reinforcements. We kept getting reinforcements up, you know.
Yeah. And how long did you stay there at Solemnes?
Oh, a couple of 3 days, that sort of thing, you know.
Were you actually involved in action there, fighting the Germans?
No, after we'd gone through Avesnes, we stopped there, and then we had a rest there, and then now we're turned to jump forward again. And I think the next time we jumped forward was at this Solesnes. And then we went through the Mormal Forest then.
Were you in action at any time along this march forward?
Big pardon?
Were you in action at any time?
I don't think we had any particular action, but we were involved in shelling. But some of the people in the other sections were. You see, you could run into a pocket. You could run into a place where the enemy were holed up. You might think it was empty, but when you got in there, you'd find you were caught in a trap. But I never got involved in any of that sort of thing.
Okay, perhaps you could continue then describing your march forward.
We kept marching forward and stopping in various villages.
Can you remember any of their names as you moved forward?
No, I can't remember them at all, no. Montchilly Grand, I think, was one. Montchilly Petit, I think that was the two of the places. But right at the very, very end of the war, around about, the 7th or 8th, a very funny thing happened. We went into a village, and there were civilians in this village, and me and another fella were put into a house, and we actually just slept that night in sheets, white sheets, with all our lousy clothing. And I remember next morning we had some lapin, rabbit, you know, at their table. Most marvellous thing that ever happened in my life, that was sleeping in that bed that night with this bloke. In a bedroom, proper bedroom, in a house. And we had all our equipment. War was going on. The two of us in there, other people in other houses. And I remember having this meal with the family. Yeah, I remember it was rabbit. I can remember it very
How
well.
Did they treat you?
Oh, marvellous. Made a great fuss of us. Oh, yes. And I remember another place where we went to. We stopped at a village there. As we were walking forward, you know, we kept stopping at villages, and we stopped at this village, and they had a dead man there. The German had shot the father. The family were all crying, you know. The dead man was lying in the garden. He was the grandfather of the house, and the German had shot him, and he was lying there dead.
Why had they shot him, do you know?
They'd shot him. His dead body was there. They were all crying around the house, in that little village. Yeah.
Were you able to do anything?
No, couldn't do anything at all. Yeah. I remember another village I went through with him. There was a big, fat German. I think Big Daddy, the wrestler, would be a puny man to him. His stomach was all gashed open, and all his intestines were like on his, you know. And somebody'd stuck a pipe in his mouth, and he had his helmet on there, his pickle derby, and he didn't half look a sight. This big fat German with his pipe in his mouth and his pickle gruber on his, and all his intestines lying out on his belly. He was lying out in a street, you know, popped up against a house.
Did you find it amusing at the time?
I did indeed, yeah. We all told him to get up.
Looking back on it now, do you think?
There was no battle going on, you see, there. Mm. You're very, very rarely involved in battle. If people were involved in a battle in the last week or two of the war, they were very unfortunate. Although I've read, look at that poet, Wilfred Owen. He was killed in the last week of the battle, wasn't he? Mm. He must have been unlucky with a shell, or he must have been in an area where there was a pocket of resistance. It's just like that, you see, just your luck. Mm-hmm. You're lucky, you know, you've got to be lucky.
Were you in action at all before the armistice was signed?
Oh, yes, yeah. Could
you describe what happened then?
Well, you'd go forward to a particular place, and you'd find that the infantry in front of you were firing, and there might be a couple of tanks firing, and you'd just go up and join them. If you was told by your bloke to put your machine gun down and fire on that house, you'd do it, you see. But no hand-to-hand fighting, nothing like that. It was all firing by, you know, a machine gun. You could see the Germans running around 300 or 400 or 500 yards away, and you fire at them. They were probably putting up a bit of resistance, but then in the end they'd get fed up and go off and leave you to it. That sort of thing.
For how many days did you march forward before you were put into rest and allowed to stop at a particular place?
Well, as far as I can remember, you'd stop at a rest place, and then have you be there about a day or so, and then you'd march forward, and you perhaps march forward about 2 days before you'd catch up with the action, you see, and then you'd go and do your little bit of stuff, then you'd stop again and rest for a couple of days. And if he went on to the action again, you'd have to march a long way before he got to the action, because the action was going away quicker than you could get up. Except, as I say, in these places where they put up resistance. They did in many places, you know, especially in the big towns.
Were you involved in any of those?
No, I never got in much there. I never went through any big towns. The biggest towns near me was where we ended up in an armistice was a place called Bavay. On our left was the Valenciennes, and on our right was Maubeuge, and a little distance in front was Mons. So we were in a triangle of those three towns.
Whilst you were marching forward so quickly, were you able to get your rations?
Yeah, there's no difficulty at all, because the mobile cookers used to come with us, you see. When we was marching along the road, the cookers would come with us. As a matter of fact, they'd almost come up to the action, and we could get our meals from the cookers, the mobile cookers. There was no going for rations or anything like that. Except when we stopped, the mobile cookers would all be there. So there was no self-cooking, none of that. We just lived off the cookers, the mobile cookers. I think that applied to everybody.
Can you remember what the effects of battle were on you? Because you must have been very, very active
for
a long period of time.
The only thing that worried us was lack of sleep. It was a very tiring, you know, slogging along and all that sort of thing. Although when we got to where we were going, we used to have a fair amount of rest. But when we stopped at a place after we'd taken the the objective. We had a lot of things to do. We had to replenish everything, you see. Get recruits, you know, reinforcements and all that sort of thing. Because the people who started out in the first place, very, very few finished up at the end. It would be completed by various groups of reinforcements that kept coming. Not only men, but ammunition and guns and horses and mules, wagons, everything, you know. So that when you started out in your next thing, you would be more or less up to scratch, as well as could be expected anyway.
Okay, thank you. Can you remember first thinking that the war was about to end? How did you come to think those thoughts?
Well, it came into our minds because we knew the enemy were advancing that quick, that a time would come when they would either have to stop in Berlin or something like that. Apart from that, we had letters from home, newspapers from home, and we knew from the newspapers that the Bulgarians and the Romanians and the Turks had sued for an armistice. That was in the newspapers. And Mr. Rumor told us that the Germans were also negotiating for an armistice, and that we knew that the war was going to end, and we were quite happy and confident that we would be there when it ended. And then sometime, just about a day or two before, we got the idea that it would end on the 11th of November.
Mm-hmm. And we was were that through rumour, or that was being rumor. Told?
And that was a very, very strong rumour. And on the 10th, I remember we went forward on the 10th, we knew it would was going to end on the 11th. And we weren't officially notified till 11 o'clock on the morning of the 11th.
Yes, can you remember your situation when you were actually told the armistice had been signed?
I remember it quite well. We went forward to this town, Bavay. We got in there about late in the afternoon. Daylight, I think it was, late in the afternoon. And we didn't go in the town. We stopped on the outskirts. We had a specific place to stop. And we went into some barns and just squat down for the night. Next morning, we went about our business, got our breakfast from the cookers. And then at 11 o'clock, we fell in. And I remember an officer reading out this proclamation that the war would end at 11 o'clock. And he just dismissed us, and we just saluted and dismissed. There was no demonstration of any kind. Nobody said a word. Everybody just slumped away. They might have been kicking up hell in Trafalgar Square and in Paris, but they never bothered a bit. Nobody took a bit of notice of it.
Why do you think that was?
I don't know. There was no euphoria at all. But I can remember this definitely. Nobody said a word. They might have said in their mind, thank God it's over, or, well, they were right about it, you know, that sort of thing. But we just slumped back. That night we went down into Bavay, which had been occupied by our troops. There we found a canteen open, had some beer, come back. Next morning, we had our orders to march away to a place called Tournai in Belgrade. That was our destination where we were going to be left. And then we knew the armistice was on, because when we marched away, we had to shine our boots and clean our buttons. We knew the war was over then, when we had to shine our buttons.
Was that perhaps the first realisation?
That was the first realisation, really, that we knew the war was over.
How did you feel at that
point? Oh, no, nothing. Didn't feel much about it. Just grumbled a bit, having to clean our buttons, but they made us clean our buttons. Had to look smart walking through the enemy towns. I think we marched through Valencian, through her, and one or two places.
Did you feel, in any sense, any sort of relief at escaping death or injury?
Yes, I suppose I did, but it wasn't very manifest, and we didn't make a big thing about it. First thing we did was write home, say we were all right, you know, first thing we did. Making sure we got the date on the envelope right, so that... incidentally, when this bloke was reading out the arm, we could still hear guns going in the distance. Still hear him booming away, long-range guns. Not for long, but I didn't honestly hear some guns going at...
Could you tell whether they were German or British?
Couldn't tell. Still heard him at 11 o'clock booming, a long way off. A lot of fancy were Germans.
As you marched through these towns, or indeed when you were at Bavay, was there any celebration by the local population?
Not at all. They didn't bother with us. Not a bit. Not a bit.
Did you have any reaction to that yourself? Do you think they...
I can remember going through one town. I think it was called Denain, where they were pulling up the tram lines. And the blinking workmen were annoyed because they had to stop because we went by. I got that impression. They didn't look on us very kindly. I don't know whether they were putting them down after having been taken up, or whether they were... I should think they were putting them down again. Yeah, I remember them.
Did that bother you at all? That
No. We were happy singing and whistling. It took a long time to get to Tournai. We stopped in various villages, you know. Yes, yes. Hung up for two or three nights and marched on for two or three nights. Of course, we had to cope with a plan laid down by headquarters. We didn't just walk to Torn. It was a long way off. It took us till Christmas time to get there, to Tournai.
And can you tell me what happened at Tournai?
Well, we went into a big apartment store in Tournai. My company were billeted on the second floor of this Tournai. We didn't do any work, nothing much. We had our Christmas dinner there, great big slap-up dinner, a real thing. I don't know who made it, I'm sure, but we had our Christmas dinner there. And a couple of days after that, I went on leave.
Was that leave back to the United Kingdom?
I went on leave to the United Kingdom for 2 weeks.
I see. When you got back home, did people at home know anything at all about what the war was really like?
Well, I mean, they had an idea, but I don't think they really knew what it was like.
Did you talk to them about it?
Oh, yes, we did, yes. I had several pals who was in the war. We used to talk about it a lot. Oh, yeah, we knew. They knew what it was like, but probably not in so much detail that we knew.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Could you tell me how you were greeted by people who had not been out in the war as coming back? Did they greet you as a sort of hero, or did you get sort of people buying you drinks?
No, I don't think so. We weren't unique in going back then. Thousands and thousands of people had been back and gone and been killed and all that. So we were not important at all in that respect. Nobody made a fuss about us. We just went back. Just dropped our civvy clothes on and went to the dance. The only thing that really did annoy me was this. When I went back to work, after I'd got demobilised, I went back to work, you see, and I went to the, you know, to the office, and they said, all right, go down the stores and get some so-and-so and tools and report to numbers. I went down the stores, and the bloke behind the counter was a bloke who I knew. He said, where have you been? On nights, he said. I could have looked him down with a phone. I'd been away in the war. He said, have you been on nights? You know, I thought, oh, my God, that's a fine reception.
Otherwise, what
did
you say to him?
I didn't say, no, I've been away in war. Oh, he said, I didn't know that. Thought you'd been on nights. But otherwise, they didn't make a fuss, any bother. No. Nobody run around and hung flags out. When I went home, the very first thing that I did was go down our street to a woman who was one of my pals who was killed. He was in the machine gun corps. We used to get letters and mail, and I remember I just wrote a letter to this bloke, posted it. He was in the 3rd Division, and then our mail come up, and in our mail was always pictures of people who'd been killed, and there was this bloke's picture, he'd been killed, you know, Jackson, been killed. And I went down to his house, and his mother, oh, she was very, very bitter towards me. Her son had been killed, and I'd come back alive. Very, very bitter. Oh, she nearly, she'd have had a frying pan, she'd have hit me. She was very, very bitter. Very bitter.
How did you feel about that? It was hardly your fault.
Couldn't feel anything about it. But a peculiar thing happened many, many years ago. The last time I went, no, not the last time, one time I went to France, one of my nieces had a nephew who was killed, and he was buried in a cemetery. And she asked me and my wife if we'd go and put some flowers on it. So we did do. But it so happened that we went at night time on a taxi. I didn't pay for it. The war paid for it. And we found this bloke's grave. And we put it on. Then afterwards, when we got back home, my niece produced one of these grave things where all the graves they were on there. And I looked through this grave, and not only was this girl's uncle there, but this bloke, Jack Jackson, he was buried in that cemetery, and my own cousin from Birmingham were in that cemetery. We didn't know. We didn't know that. We found his grave, our nephew's grave. We found that and put the flowers on and came back. But it was in the dark, but we looked in the book to find out where his grave was, but we didn't go through the book. And so when they got back home, she produced this book. The cemetery was at Pernes, P-N-E-R-S, Pernes in Artois. It was a cemetery where a lot of wounded people had died. And there he was, this Jack Jackson, who I'd wrote to, he was buried in there, and my own cousin from Birmingham. That's all this bit of coincidence, wasn't it? Eh? Mm. That was what? Oh, only about 5 or 6 years ago.
Now, just to return to your first homecoming, what was the reaction of your parents to you turning
to the
doorstep?
They didn't know I was coming home. I arrived home in about the first train in the morning and walked home and opened the door. The door was open. I just walked in. Father was at work. Ooh, and they went mad about the Russian car. The Russian car. I'll tell you something else. I had a tin of bully beef in my iron rations. This is a thing you never open. They ate that. They went mad on that. A tin of bully beef, yeah. And there were thousands and thousands of Tindall building entrenchments with them. And that, this Tindall bully was in my own rations. And they enjoyed that. Food was very bad, you know. Mm. But, and I had some Russian cards. And they were very, very pleased with Russian cards. Yeah.
Can you think of any other instances of events that happened when you were on leave?
Well, the very first thing I did was went to the shipyard to get this document, which our officer said would facilitate our demobilisation. I got that without any trouble. They gave it me right away. Then I spent the rest of the fortnight doing nothing.
What was the document that you actually got?
It was a piece of paper certifying that me was an apprentice plater in Vickersville, and that my job was ready, waiting for me to go back into, you see. They said that if I had one of them, it would help me in... Everybody would help them in demobilisation, see. Well, I had that, see, so I went back with them. I had that in my possession when I went back on leave, with the intention of taking it back to Tournai. Mm-hmm.
What was your feeling about having to go back into France, after having fought the war?
I didn't bother, me. I didn't bother much. Everybody seemed to want to go back, until these Canadian and Australian people started this racket.
Did you want to go back yourself?
I wasn't bothered about it, no. I had no reason to go back. I was quite content to be at home.
Mm-hmm. So you'd rather have stayed at home rather than go back?
Oh, right. I'd have sooner stopped. If I'd have had a choice, I would have stopped at home. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you tell me what happened then on your journey back to France?
To where?
To France.
I didn't get back to France. I didn't go
Can
back.
Can you tell me about that then, please?
Well, I left Barrow at night time, about 5 o'clock at night, travelled overnight, got in at Euston, and... When I got to Euston, there was an underground strike on. There was an underground strike on. And I happened to know the way from Euston to Victoria. I knew a bit about London. And I actually acted as a guide with a crowd of people following me, and we got to Victoria. Well, when they got to Victoria, I was only looking at it this morning. When I was on the bus, I thought, well, about 60, 70, 80 years ago, I stood on this bit of ground. And we got there, we couldn't get near the entrance. Crowds of Canadians, Australian, you wouldn't go back. I couldn't get in there.
Go back to where?
Wouldn't go back to France. They wanted to be demobilised on leave. They wanted some action. Well, the military police came along, and they formed us all in a line outside the Victoria Station, and we walked down Victoria Street to Chelsea Barracks, and we went into Chelsea Barracks. In Chelsea Barracks, there were a lot of huts, and we all got processed through there. The process was that they sent everybody back home on leave for 2 weeks, asking them to get a document to say that they had a job available, gave them the Russian cards and money. I don't know what they did with the Canadians, I wasn't sure, but that's what happened to me. While I'm standing there, there's another man there in a machine gun corps, and he came along to me, and I remember him saying, "Hey," he said, "do you know where the machine gun corps record office is?" And I said, "Yes, I do. It's in York Road." He said, "Do you know where it is?" I said, "Yes, I do." He said, "Well, I'm going there." He said, I've got one of these, you know." I said, "Well, so have I." And he said, "Well, come on then."
One of these what? Sorry.
Well, one of these bits of paper.
That you got from the shipyard?
That he'd got one from us. He said, "Come on then." So I was only young. I went with this bloke, and we went into this office. He said, "I remember," he said, "have you got any money?" And I think I'd got about a couple of quid. He said, "Give us 10 bob. So I give him 10 bob. Went in there, and we got processed there. And we got some documents, and we went off to Crystal Palace. Got the mob there. I think we got out at Penge. Is that anywhere near Crystal Palace? Penge.
Yes, I think it probably is.
I think we got out at Penge.